Ah, December. The days are shorter, the weather's colder, and pundits and prognosticators are rolling out their predictions of what 2017 might bring. But after a bit of spiked eggnog at the non-denominational holiday party at Packet Pushers HQ, we thought it might be more fun to look backward instead of forward. The premises for today's episode is, did anything change in 2016? And because we've already strip-mined our own navels in epic bouts of gazing, we decided to invite a few friends to help us peer into the fog of spin, hype, and marketing that blanketed the past 12 months to see if there's anything really different in the industry. So joining me and Greg Farrow and Ethan Banks are our friends Stephen Foskett, Keith Townsend, and Chris Wall. Welcome, gentlemen.
Peace.
Hello.
Woo!
Woo! Crowd's gone wild.
Yes, they are.
We're going to hope Skype can stand up for this and see what happens. But Greg, this was your idea, so why don't you kick us off and tell us, what do you think? Did anything change this year, 2016?
I don't know. It's pretty hard to tell. I mean, I was talking to a customer the other day, and they're still connecting their servers at 1 gig. They're buying storage arrays with hard disks in them that use a protocol that was developed in the 1970s. Their servers have one CPU. They run VMware on a few of them, about half of them, but they don't run more than 5 VMs on them because they're scared that something might break. Now, all of their apps come from other people's vendors. They don't write their own. They don't do DevOps. They do everything under ITIL with change control, with Prince2 project managers, and they have zero plans on changing anything. So from where I'm standing, nothing's changed. And yeah, we've spent all year talking about it.
So well, I guess we're done then.
Yeah.
Bye, everybody.
Mike, draw. Good talk with you.
Yeah. Why did you dig up these old customers? Like, who? What? I stopped doing that back in the mid-2000s, man.
Yeah, I was looking up an ITC report, and they still sell more hard disk drives than we do flash today. And that made me sad.
Well, and, it's not possible to manufacture enough flash memory to replace the capacity of hard disk drives. We don't have that industrial capacity on the planet.
No, not yet. And yet, everything that we've talked about this year is 25 gig, 50 gig Ethernet and open source operating systems, disaggregated systems, converged, hyper-converged, flash drives, flash storage arrays, NVMe to access your storage arrays instead of SCSI or NFS or whatever, or some sort of block storage. And I just wonder, what's changed? Has anybody actually seen any appreciable change in the market in that time? I don't know where you want to start this one, but for me, it's like, although we've talked about all of these things, about, like SD-WAN and, ASICs and merchant silicon and in networking and all that, is it really happening, or is it just like something that we set up here, like in our cloud tower built on cloud foundations and make noises?
Well, I talked to a young engineer about 3 weeks ago, and she came to one of my sessions that I was giving for Tech Target or whatever. It was, one of these future of data center type of deals where we're talking pie in the sky, DevOps, all these things that could happen. And afterwards, she walked up to me and she said, "You know what, Keith, really great talk, but I came here to understand what the future is. All that stuff that you're talking about doing in the future, we did that stuff 2, 3, 4 years ago, and I'm getting bored, and I'm wondering what can I do next to get kind of ahead of the curve." And I kind of looked at it. She was quite a short woman. I'm like, wow, you're worth your weight in gold, because I have not ran into anyone outside of, the mystical valley. And she worked for just a regular financial services company. So I guess it happens out there, but you know what? I still struggle with having daily conversations about why you shouldn't go with your big name vendor of networking vendor of choice, their SD-WAN solution, because it's not really SD-WAN. I'm still struggling through some of those conversations.
So let me ask this then, because so Chris Wall called out Greg saying maybe that's just the customer's fault for doing things the old way. You mentioned, Keith, that this woman is working at a financial service company. And I feel like among the enterprise companies, financial services tends to be the one that will actually pour money into IT and something new because they feel like they can use it as a competitive advantage. So is it the technology, or is it the organization, or some combination?
Well, my opinion is, the organization. If you go and, Greg talks about this whole concept of waiting, basically living off the tit of your vendor and waiting for the vendor to come and tell you what you should do next. And even when you're having advanced conversations about SD-WAN, cloud aggregation, or whatever, we're waiting for Dell EMC, Cisco, NetApp, all these traditional vendors to come back and tell us what to do from the executive ranks. And when you talk about the engineers, you know, some of the forward-thinking engineers, you know, they're really frustrated and kind of dismissing some of these traditional vendors and really want to go either with this DevOps movement and investing in software themselves or going with a smaller vendor that the startup that's really forward-thinking.
Do you think one of the problems things that we see vendors say to us is we will make products that customers want to buy? And so my frustration is when customers say to me, well, we would need to get the vendor to make a commitment to support that product that we want to buy. And that seems like one of these vicious circles where the vendors want to make products that customers will buy, but the customers only want to buy products that vendors will make and support.
Yeah, and it is one of those chicken and egg kind of things, as you mentioned. I mean, you know, then that's been a big problem in IT for a long time, right? You'll see vendors go off kind of half-cocked on some crazy new idea that'll come up and, you know, the customers will say, oh, this is crazy. I don't want to go that direction, whatever. And then maybe they'll be gun shy the next time and they won't, you know, support something new or do something new. And, you know, I don't agree with your premise that nothing has changed, especially in storage. But I will say that, as you point out, storage is a real, you know, kind of lagging indicator, and it has been resistant to change. And frankly, one of the reasons for that is because nobody really wants to change. They really just want it to work. And that's been such a challenge for so long that they're willing to put up with old, out-of-date stuff in order to just continue working. And that has been a real drag on the industry as new products and technologies come out. People don't adopt them.
Hmm. Is that because people believe that vendors should come and tell them that this is the product, that this is the future? Like the other part of this cycle of, you know, customers will only buy products that vendors say they want, but vendors won't make a product that customers won't say they want to buy. Is part of that because vendors used to give us leadership? Vendors used to make one thing and then they would come out and say, this is the future. This is what we're betting our company on. And the customer would feel, that's great. I know that that company is standing behind that product because they're betting the business on it. Whereas now we have companies like HP, Dell, Cisco, who say, we make one of everything. We've got one for every choice, Mr. Customer. So now you have to make up your mind. And then we end up in a sort of a decision paralysis, like, you know, today you can buy 1 gig switches, 10 gig switches, 25 gig switches, 50 gig, 100 gig, 40 gig. Now it's up to you to make a decision about what you want. And I'm seeing customers sit there saying, well, you know what? Like, I don't feel the need to actually do, I'll just buy 1 gig switches because it's cheap. I just feel that sometimes that the vendors have sort of let us down in the sense that they don't fix anything anymore. They don't put their butts on the line and say, this is where, there's no leadership. They don't say, this is the future. They don't say, this is how it's going to look. All they give us is, we'll sell you whatever you want to buy. And the customer says, well, I want to buy what you want to sell me. And then there's a sort of wishy-washy process, which ends up selling them. The customer ends up buying the most profitable product for the vendor that's least suited to their business.
So I'm going to jump in then and say one thing that I do think that has changed then in 2016, if we're looking for change, is that we're finally starting to see this dynamic shake out a little bit, because really big companies like Google or Facebook or Amazon don't have to rely on a vendor anymore to get the products they need. They can do their own internal development. They can go to OEMs and ODMs and say, this is what we're after. You build it, we'll run it, and just cut out the sort of vendor as middleman. So of course, not every enterprise has that kind of leverage or capability, but we're now starting to see that ability trickle down from the Facebooks and the Googles of the world to the general enterprise, where you can get disaggregated hardware and software. You can get, you know, a set of routing protocols that are separate from the OS so that you don't have to add a bunch of features that you don't need. And people aren't necessarily adopting it yet, but that dynamic is starting to change because some big companies finally said, you know what, the vendors aren't meeting our needs. We're going to do it ourselves.
Being someone that's actually on the side of working for a vendor, I've had the very interesting perspective of watching a market that, as a consultant, you know, the data protection space, which is where I work, has been stagnant and has been exactly what Drew and Greg, what you're talking about. It's like, here's next year's thing. It's not any better than it was before. the other five people that make the thing are pretty much all the same. It's basically just who do you want to get screwed by? And we're saying, hey, there is a better way. In some cases, we don't provide, as an example of kind of a new, I'm not trying to be an advertisement, just, you know, hey, something new in the market. We don't provide everything that was in the classic sense of what data protection is, because that's the whole thing of if I asked people what they wanted, they'd want a faster horse instead of the car. So yeah, you have to show some visionary leadership there. It's not going to completely be a Venn diagram overlap with what has been, because that's how you make progress to move forward. So yes, I can't be cynical on that one, because I believe I work for a company that is moving the needle forward and offering customers what they actually want. You know, maybe they didn't know it, but moving forward, they kind of felt that it was right. And once you see it, you're like, yeah, that's really cool. However, yeah, you're bringing up vendors like HP and Dell and those kind of folks who are just looking to ship 10 in the, you know, faster, newer form factor.
Yeah, so if you look back at the core of what you're describing, Drew, you're talking about where is the customer pushing the vendor, or how is the customer enabling disruption in tech industry? And if we look at 2016, I think AWS reInvent, 32,000 people, just ridiculously large for our industry, infrastructure in specific. Those business folks that are now bypassing IT and just saying, you know what, you guys don't get it. I'm going to a vendor in AWS that understands what I want and gives me what I want. And if you guys have to react or do whatever you need to do, fine, whatever. I have product to sell. I have messages to get out. I have business needs that a vendor is meeting. We're seeing that in, you know, the Facebooks of the world and pushing, you know, and AWS saying, you know what, AWS saying, we're just not going to use a network vendor. LinkedIn building their own stuff. And now the business community going out to cloud and building their technology to spec. The question is, will IT get to that point? And me, Greg, and Kelsey Hightower had a conversation late last year during an Intel event around this basic thing. The question I have is, does that talent actually exist in enterprise IT to push vendors to get to for change?
I think there's two things in there. One is I'm still unconvinced that enterprise IT, and it's not technical knowledge that they don't have, it's leadership. So the problem with companies like you saw this week, we saw British Petroleum or BP, the company saying they're all in with the public cloud. And the reason was is because they said, the CIO basically said, we can't be in some private cloud because people then go and put things in private cloud that should be in public cloud. So he is going to take everything into the public cloud, not because it's the right thing to do, but because he's actually re-engineering the change. He can't get his executives in control of the IT departments. They can't actually execute on the strategies. They can't control what's happening. And so they end up doing this stuff, which is we're going to send everything to the public cloud. And in fact, they don't in the end. But that's what they say outside. Certainly gets a nice discount at Amazon, I'm sure.
But yet we've also seen, sort of the failure of a lot of these clouds. You know, Cisco's shutting theirs down after dumping $1 billion into it.
VMware shutting down, just walking back from there. VCloud Air walking back from partners.
Everybody wanted to have to have a public cloud, and just like everybody wanted a tablet and a smartphone. You know, we'll see how that works out.
But that was such a horrible DNA match to have a infrastructure vendor want to build a public cloud, really just so that they could have a place to sell their own tin. Didn't really make a lot of sense to me. You know, these aren't the kind of folks that have a lot of experience or really business building public cloud offerings, in my opinion.
I think they were always half-hearted. Like building vCloud Air from VMware was a way of keeping private clouds working. Like customers who want, you know, that was a defensive move. It wasn't an offensive or
a business
strategy.
Yeah, that's true. And you contrast that to Microsoft, for example, where, you know, essentially the company decided to jump in with both feet. I think Microsoft is cloud first, and I think that's one reason that Azure has done so well. Also because they're pouring tons of resources into it and it's really full featured, but nobody would argue that Cisco or VMware was going to be cloud first.
And I think if you look at who VMware and Cisco was marketing their cloud to. I think I don't think they really understood the business problem. You know, I've gotten a lot of flack on that brutal blog post I wrote on VMware's vCloud Air just not being production ready. And I stand by it. It wasn't, it isn't. And that's why it's dying. I don't want to get too cranky on this podcast, but it should die a very quick death. My son, who's a developer, couldn't get onto vCloud Air and do what it is that he wanted to do. He could go to AWS, Azure, and do what he wanted to do. Cisco Cloud, who are they marketing the solution to? They're marketing the solution to us. I don't develop. I couldn't tell you the first thing that I needed in a public cloud, but I knew how to. I understood how to use vCloud Air, which made no sense, of course, to the person who actually needs it, which was a developer.
I think there's a big difference between, so AWS doesn't actually offer a solution. All it does is sells building blocks. So, and there's a massive gap here between comprehension that just baffles me. Like Enterprise says they're going to AWS and they're actually getting less functionality out of AWS than they get out of their current infrastructure because AWS doesn't offer a solution. It doesn't run the software for you. It doesn't run the servers for you. What it does is it gives you an ES instance, and then you have to still make that work. Or if you want to use Lambda or serverless or any, and then what you've got to do is glom them all together yourself. And I think the mistake the vendors made, you know, the incumbent vendors made with their clouds was they were actually trying to provide solutions. They weren't just going to try and sell you an ES instance and say, buy, and, you know, and if it rebooted and you lost 2 years worth of data, too bad, that's your problem. They didn't comprehend that. They tried it to say, well, we'll sell you a backup service and of this, and of that, and of this, and of that. And then, of course, they don't look competitive. And then, you know, there's a massive gap between public clouds, which are like Lego blocks, and what we do today in IT, which is where the SAP comes in and says, here's the software, this is how it's going to work, here's a team of consultants that are going to deploy it for you, you have to buy this software and you have to have this much bandwidth, this much storage, this, and you have to back this up, you have to do this. The world of difference between these two is so vast. And I think the incumbent vendors came in with the solution-oriented mindset. And public cloud is not a solution. It doesn't fix, it doesn't do anything other than what you have to make yourself. And I don't think people have worked that out. Is that?
Well, that's a real irony, isn't it, Greg? I mean, if that's true, wow, that's incredible. So essentially what you're saying is that the thing that incumbent vendors have always offered to the enterprise is the very thing that turns off the enterprise when it comes to cloud.
Yeah.
Well, the thing that turns them off is the IT department. It's the classic, it's the conundrum that we put ourselves into when we siloed off our skill sets and created all these different specialties, made it take, you know, 12 months or so to stand up infrastructure. It's obviously reduced now, but everything it takes to stand up infrastructure so that we can start doing work and standing up services and applications is what they want to eliminate by consuming public cloud. You abstract all that to someone who's really good at it and has automated the crap out of it, whereas we're still trying to figure out DevOps and config management and things that are just like no-brainers but take a lot of effort and a lot of culture shift internally. So that to me is the value of the public cloud. Yeah, it's less valuable at the end of the day if you were to take all the services and stretch them out, but there's a lot of value in compressing that timeline and removing all the crap that the culture kind of poison puts in the way.
So you're removing things starting at the bottom of the stack and moving up, just like, you know, software development is focusing more higher in the stack now. You're saying that the cloud is most attractive when it eliminates things at the bottom of the stack and less attractive when it removes things from the top of the stack, unless you've got no stack.
Look at
businesses and individuals. I mean, they want the whole thing. They just want, you know, applications as a service, right?
Well, I even got into this recently for my own intents and purposes. I wanted to work with an application. I have a fairly nice home lab, and I know this isn't enterprise IT home lab, but I was like, man, actually, you have to go download the current version of Red Hat and install it and configure it and give it an IP and stuff. Like, nah, I'm just going to spin up something in Azure and go from there, and it's going to take me 30 seconds. And I eliminated my own self. I like built this whole lab up and I didn't even use it because I'm like, it's too much work.
So Chris, literally last night, I said to myself, you know what? I like to play around with Wireshark. I haven't played around with it in a while. I have a lab, but I went to AWS, spent up a mini service and installed Wireshark in AWS because it was faster than I could have done it in my own home lab. So there you go.
So it doesn't. It's not necessarily then the cloud is providing a better product. It's providing a product that's easy to consume and fast.
So Drew, I asked a business user the other day who's a really substantial AWS user. He doesn't have DR. He doesn't have a DR process. He doesn't have backup. He doesn't have all these things that we worry about in enterprise IT to protect the business. And I asked him in all his naivety, I said, what would you change about AWS if you could? And he paused, gave it thought for about 20 seconds and said, if I could change anything, I'd ask that I had a faster connection to AWS.
So you didn't care about all that other stuff?
No. And it's, you know, it's the newness of course that stuff matters, but trying to Greg's point, trying to sell that stuff in a package solution to a business user that looks at AWS and looks at the pennies per minute or hour for compute versus the $3 per hour that we're going to charge once we bundle those solutions and services on top, they don't comprehend the value off the bat.
So maybe the question then is, have we seen an organization really get burned by a cloud provider in terms of actually losing production data? I don't think that's happened. We always hear about an outage or something, but is that what it's going to take for people to say, wait a minute, maybe this rush to the public cloud isn't great. Or if we're going to go public cloud, we also need to then build on HA, disaster recovery, backup, et cetera, all those things that IT does that we hate, but really should be
there. It's the bill, man. It's the bill. That's the only reason that you leave. When you get everyone I talk to, it's like, well, we're paying $250,000 a month. That's kind of high. What are we going to do? Like, that's the only reason you would really leave. Because otherwise, it's great. But it's like renting a car constantly. The bills add up. It's great. You just get a new car every day, and it's awesome. But man, it's expensive.
And then suddenly you realize, I'm actually paying five times what it would cost to own a car. So I often question, I mean, I understand the seduction, the seductive factor that public clouds have, but I think there's a reality filter. And, you know, it was this time last year that everybody was saying, we're going to see massive discounts in the public cloud. It's going to, effectively, the price is going to vanish to zero within a year, you know. And yet this year we've seen effectively zero discounts on public cloud services. And in fact, the prices are actually getting more expensive. And there's lots of, and all the cloud pundits have been apologizing for that and going, they're keeping prices high to keep demand down so that they can build it out. They've got no problem with that. They're just making a killing, you know, like a real profit, not just a little, but a lot.
So maybe we'll pivot a little bit from cloud toward a topic that Stephen wanted to talk about, which, using a nice New England accent, would be Docker.
Docker, yeah. Docker.
How's your Docker?
Let's talk about Docker.
Good, your Docker?
Crikey.
Yeah, crikey. So, you know, one of the things that just came to mind when I was listening to you guys, though, and oh my gosh, it suddenly, you know, becomes real to me. Docker is doing the same thing that you're saying the cloud is doing. So I was actually just this weekend, and actually during this week too. So I've got my own, I've been running Docker at home, and I transitioned it over to a bigger, badder server because I had enough containers running on it, you know, doing various, various infrastructure things at home and playing around with it. Like Chris's home lab, you know, I mean, I went through the same thing. You know, I built out a whole VMware home lab, and then I just said, I hate this, and ripped it apart, and then I ran Docker on one of them, and then I said, kind of hate this, and moved that in with my file server, and so now I've got, you know, everything on one machine, and there again, it's the same reason. You know, the thing that I love about Docker is that, you know, I'm basically, you know, I've now got a container image that I like. I like Debian, so I use Debian. You know, whenever I want to run something, I just pop up another container based on that image and, you know, run it. And if I like it, I like it. I can keep it going. If I don't, I blow it away. And And it's the same benefit that you're saying that the cloud gives you, in that, you know, you're not messing around with stuff. You're not messing around with configuration and everything. You just, you know, pop it up. If you like it, you like it, and you keep it. If you don't, you don't. It's kind of like, you know, kind of like a personal cloud almost.
I kind of get the feeling that public cloud isn't the destination in the end. I suspect that we'll have a you know, there are things that are in the public cloud because that's the right place for them. Close location to lots of bandwidth.
Yeah, some stuff wants to live in the cloud. You know, email wants to be in the cloud.
Yes, that's right. And there's going to be and there's going to be services which are much better in a private privately hosted, and it can even be small scale manufacturing, like a closet. You can get an awful lot of compute into one rack in a closet at an office for non-core functionality, and, you know, back it up to the public cloud. But I do wonder if so many people, in their excitement to get away from the problems of infrastructure, and maybe talking about the problems of infrastructure is really the story of 2016, where we've really realized how awful private data centers are in terms of cost of ownership, how inflexible they are, how the technology is more important than the solution, the fact that our, you know, CIOs and CTOs and the people in charge of IT businesses have no business running them because they're all incompetent, fumbling idiots, and that vendors have far too much control over what customers buy, and customers are buying stuff which suits the vendors but doesn't actually give a benefit to their businesses. And we're starting to see this discussion. I mean, the rise of software-defined net storage, networking, servers is now starting to talk about how can I build public cloud-like features, you know, the features that we want, click a button, services.
The things running, we like.
The things we like. And now the technologies, now that the discussion's starting to happen, the technologies that support that, like containers, like flexible storage, like flexible networking, that, you know, I don't know how the physical network works. I don't care. I just want my security posture to be this. And here's where my security, here's my segmentation, is my micro segmentation. Can I delete this? Yes. I don't need to go and raise a change request and sit through 3 months of meetings to add and delete something. Can I go for micro change because change is reliable? Yes, I can do that. If I go to Docker and SDN and software defined storage and automated backups and mirrors, you know, automated snapshots and backup utility, all that, that's just the way I feel. Is it, you know, we're in some sort of transition state where public cloud has now proved to us that this is where we need to be, and now we're all looking at our private cloud saying, how do we get there? And for me, the biggest story in 2016 is the vendors are just sitting there looking at going, I have no idea how I'm going to build a product that does that, because I have all these problems to solve. But in the meantime, I've got to produce $5 billion worth of sales of products that nobody wants to buy.
And then here comes hyperconverged infrastructure to say, hey, we've got your solution, and we're not one of these big vendors.
Yeah, I don't know about that, but it's really an asynchronous warfare thing too, because essentially, you know, you've got sort of the big bad vendors with their big bad products who are trying to build big bad competition for these new nimble, you know, things. I mean, you know, you basically have, you know, GM and Ford and Toyota sitting there looking at, you know, Tesla saying, oh yeah, we can build electric cars too. But of course their whole mindset is building one that looks like their conventional cars. Whereas, you know, you've got these startups, and there's more than Tesla, but that's the one that, you know, people like to use, saying, you know, well, who cares about all that stuff, you know? Let's look at it a different way. Let's look at it without all that overhead.
So is it safe to say that 2016 was the death of private cloud as an alternative to public cloud? The recreating AWS, Azure, and my private data center, that's not agility. That doesn't give the value we thought it would. And we're abandoning that for the Docker model, or the Kubernetes model, or the container model, because that offers that flexibility that ultimately that I'm in search of, that I get in public cloud.
Keith, how are you defining private cloud then?
Yeah.
So that whole automated space of which I'm provisioning VMs, networking, et cetera, where I'm trying to replicate AWS, this chargeback as a service model as defined by, you know, that whole NIST definition of private cloud, where I'm doing this self-service portal. I just want to recreate AWS. And so I want to squeeze 10 years of AWS in 1 year within my private data center.
I think there's a couple of things going on here. I don't think we're not, and most people tend to look at these problems as infrastructure problems. But what we're missing here is that containers and microservices is a reaction to the fact that the software that we buy from companies like SAP and Oracle aren't acceptable. We don't want to buy off-the-shelf software and have it shoved down our throats because it's not the software that we need. So when you go and buy, you know, Oracle HR or Oracle Financials, it's not flexible. It forces your company to act like an Oracle Financials company. And the realization is that if I had a development team that could write software that could, the example I was listening to the other day was a hardware, big national chain of hardware stores. And they have on the shop floor the thing that mixes paint. And there is no program, no repeatable way for them to make a paint color. So when you go up to the paint mixing shop inside of a hardware store, the man used to get out a book, look it up, and it would say so much of this, so much of that, and they would measure it out and put it. But every one of those books was different for every company's paint dispensers. And so if they changed, if a customer came back and said, I want a tin of this paint again, you can't replicate it.
And so now what that I will vouch for.
Right? And so what this company did was they wrote an app. They sat down and DevOps'd and microserviced and containerized just that one little thing, a little app that could now be deployed into the store just to solve that problem. So now they have a standardized way to do that one thing. Now, that's a small example of an iterative change that they can do one thing. But what we need to be able to do is do the same thing for our financials. So you go and buy a financials package and it does 80% of the functionality, but now you have a team of developers who do DevOps for 20% of the functionality that your business needs it to do, because you can't bend Oracle SAP into the shape that you want. It has one way of working with a billion features, because that's its idea of flexibility, is to have a billion features. Well, we know that a billion features doesn't work anymore, because a billion features means a billion problems, a billion bugs, a billion, you know, you can't release it fast because testing a billion features that nobody uses, and we know that blah, 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 so on and so on. And so I think we're sort of getting to the point where microservices is a reaction to, we need new apps to run our business. How do we get them? Well, I look at open source. If I had developers, I could write them. And I think there's a reaction there to that. So once you start DevOpsing your little heart out and microservicing and writing code, you need to iterate. It's expensive to run teams of developers at high cost. So then you build, and so there's an iteration there around microservices that comes with that. But at the same time, I think you're always going to have monoliths. You know, your legacy monoliths are going to be there for, in the same way that many companies continue to run mainframes, 50 years, 60 years of mainframes for some companies. You still need them. And I think the future of private data centers is, over here's the little area where you make microservices and it runs on a cloud-like private infrastructure that has software defined. But over here is where my monoliths are, and I treat them like 30-, 40-year-old mainframes, and somebody over there is looking after them who's just waiting to retire and can't wait to get out of the company.
I would say, going back to Keith's point, are we looking at the death of private cloud? My feeling is that we haven't actually seen a real private cloud.
Yeah, have we seen the birth yet?
Right. Yep. I don't think it's dead. It hasn't shown up yet. And Docker and Kubernetes kind of show us the way. And of course, there's going to be some problems on the back end there as we dig into it and learn more about it. And every technology has its plus and minus. But we haven't actually had a private cloud yet with the ease and usage of the public cloud.
Yeah, because every conversation, just as an example, every conversation I had around building private cloud was around, we'll show back, or we'll fake back, or we'll, you know, shame back. It's like none of those are options in public cloud. You don't just like fake the financials. You have to pay somebody. And just that model alone is mystifying, boggling, not the way IT is set up internally. So if you wanted to have any sort of fiscal responsibility associated with the services you provide with your internal IT and the people that are consuming it, just that alone is basically vaporware for 99.9% of the world. Mm.
So talking about trends and things that happened in 2016, the developer, you know, 2 years ago, I never saw a developer in my Twitter feed. Now it's all about developers and DevOps, and developers are driving the ship. Does this group feel like that's true? Is that a change that we saw in 2016, that developers are suddenly leading the way?
I feel like they were always very relevant and important. I think just as IT professionals were just now taking notice of it and being more involved in the conversation. you know, before we had that giant brick wall of separation, both from a, you know, network and community perspective, as well as a they throw stuff at us and we install it for them and tell them it's broken perspective. I think it's just now you have developer advocates and all these other roles that are trying to impress upon us as IT ops folks, hey, they've got some pretty cool methods, the way that they do the pushing of code and the way they make changes and the way that they collaborate upon that stuff. Has some pretty cool ideas there. Let's start adopting some of that. Not necessarily that they're captains of the ship in all aspects of the world, I would think.
Yeah, I would agree with that, Drew. It's not so much that they're leading the way necessarily as it's become less acceptable for a developer to be completely ignorant of infrastructure and vice versa. Infrastructure people are supposed to have some clue as far as what developers do and what it takes to deploy code. And I think the reason that the conversations are happening where we're seeing developers show up in operations conversations is because of that. We're seeing this merging of the minds and beyond a curiosity to necessity to know what the other side of the brick wall is doing and how it's being done. Because you have to get the job done effectively.
But I mean, that sounds nice, but I was just looking at a thread on a Unicorn Bacon message board, and it was a bunch of networkers very angry at the fact that they are having to contort themselves and contort their network architectures because of crappy applications.
Yeah, but there's a difference between what the average business is doing and what large businesses are doing that have specific problems to solve. And I think that's there's a disconnect between a lot of what, well, people like us talk about on podcasts, because we're talking about often huge companies with that are leading the way because they've had to solve complex problems, and the technology that they've adopted and the techniques that they've adopted haven't trickled down to the average enterprise yet. And so you've got, like we kind of opened the show with, the average enterprise is kind of stuck in their ways. They're doing things the same way very often because they don't have a compelling business driver to make the admittedly radical changes that are required to their processes that would lead them down this road that larger hyperscale companies have gone down.
I'm hearing a lot of talk about developers, but I'm really not sure that this is any more solid than all the talk about clouds.
Yeah, I've been thinking through this, and I think you can even look at the org structures within large enterprises, and the budgets are still not going to developer controlled BUs or departments. That budget is still remaining wholly in IT. There may be influence or even the advertisement of greater influence, but I don't know if I see the actual change of the developer leading, you know, bringing in the cloud aggregators and forcing the infrastructure teams to sit down and have a conversation. That I don't know if I see that happening.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't want to say that it shouldn't happen or that it's a bad thing or whatever. I'm just not quite sure that it's really real.
And I wonder, is it in part because developers don't have to go to IT anymore? They can go to Azure, they can go to Google, they can go to Amazon and just bypass IT.
To a point. When the bill gets to $250,000 a month,
a credit card starts to show up.
That's where I think that it's not so much the developer leading charge. And I think just like a mid-tier IT ops person doesn't lead the charge. You know, we all make decisions within our realm. It's more, to me, the shift around that communication of the developer community have some really great ways to collaborate on the way that they do things. And if we can treat our infrastructure more as code and collaborate with more version control and, you know, just those ideas make our life way better. And so that's where I feel like we're breaking bread a little bit and having a conversation to move forward our state of the art.
Yeah, and I think what we're running into practically, I think a lot of enterprises buy into the concept of DevOps and taking development methodologies. I think what we run into the struggle is brownfields, and we look at the muckety-muck, all the technical debt that we have over the years, SAP, Oracle, legacy MRP stuff. I walked into a data center and for last month and saw a production compact rack. I thought that was something until I walked into another facility and saw a production digital rack. I'm like, oh my goodness. So, you know, how do you DevOps that?
That reminds me of, as an aside, so for Gestalt IT, Rich Straffolino is currently writing an article. He just found an fresh off the server role Macintosh SE. So they just retired it. It had been used as a server. And he's actually writing an article about it because, oh my gosh, you're using a Mac SE as a server in 2016.
But I think that's a great point, Keith, is that brownfield, which is what most people are dealing with, is where the DevOps model runs into the buzzsaw.
Does it though?
I think so. If you don't, how do you ops an infrastructure that has almost no automation, that it's all, you know, CLI and custom scripts and...
Yeah. I mean, just the way you do anything. I mean, that's the ingenuity of a sysadmin is give them a system that doesn't have automation and out comes automation. You know, they're like the meat grinder that turns horrible into awesome, you know?
You know, the funny thing about automation is it reminds me that 25 years ago when minis and micros, do you know what system administrators used to do then? Write scripts, run batch jobs, automate everything so that it would run. Check tape. A tape job would run, and at the end of it, it would pop up a message to say that it had run successfully. We used to do all of that 25 years ago, and somewhere along the line, we stopped.
I still have a HP UX admin that all he does all day long is write scripts. The guy is really good.
But yeah. The difference now is that we always have been, I think. Good sysadmins do that sort of work. It's just now we can collaborate with one another beyond just Usenet and IRC and places where we can just kind of throw code at each other. We can put it on a GitHub project, make it searchable, see exactly who's contributed to what specific line of code that's there, etc.
I guess I feel like I take your point, but it also seems to me that in some ways scripting is just like faster firefighting, and it's not necessarily integrated. It's not system-wide necessarily, so I guess I don't see it as being, you know, full automation like we talk about in an actual private cloud or in a public cloud.
Yeah, I think historically it was a little bit of firefighting, Drew, just to comment on your quote there around scripting. But it's changing, right? It's changed. I feel like the state of the art is changing for a couple of reasons. One, we're talking to a lot of APIs now, and the libraries that we use to talk to those APIs are becoming more widespread, downloadable. The internet has changed a lot of the ways that we actually are able to pull these pieces of code, so there's better reuse. And realistically, if we could stick these into orchestration engines, which is the really big kind of change that I'm seeing, maybe not specific to 2016, but over the last 2-3 years, and something that we've talked a lot about on the day Datanauts, like with Kubernetes et al. And the CoreOS team and what they've got going on. There's a lot of engines where you can stick these things into, and it just basically, it's a config management brain that is saying, this is what things should be, and if they're not, make them so, and you can feed your scripts into them. I think that's a little bit of the difference versus just a bunch of batch files that are being hit by, you know, a task scheduler on a Windows box or a cron job on a Linux box. I think those are the major differences there. But you are right at the basic level. It is a person taking inputs, applying logic, and hopefully you get the right output to it. It's just now we can make that a little more grander scale. We can share with one another, and we can pull from more common libraries to RESTful APIs.
So maybe we can chalk that up to something that did change in 2016, or at least a change that's
definitely better. Yeah, it's definitely, and it's been a lot of fun talking to people that are doing that sort of work. In fact, I've been talking to people, their title is automation engineer at a large company. I'm like, that's kick ass. I wish I had had a job like that, or at least been recognized as that was my job. I was always like network ops guy or sysadmin or something. So I just think that it's been some change there.
I feel automation is kind of fun, but I don't feel that automation is actually going to move the needle, right? So here's my difference. I think there's two types of things going on here. One is automation and the other is orchestration. If you're going to, the thing that makes a public cloud work is orchestration. When I click a button, something happens. And that might orchestrate storage and networking and firewalls and identity management and web application firewalls or automatic creative VLANs, routing. All that stuff is all brought together. Most of the automation that we do today is like, is a bit like a Goldbergian machine where you pull a lever and all the dominoes fall in order. And it has a massive impact on companies because we're coming from such a deficit, such a bad place where we have these so incompatible solutions that have zero automation, and really all the vendors have managed to do with their products for the last 20 years is to make them get fast enough so that they're actually usable. They really haven't done anything about cost of ownership or reducing the cost of operation. And so these scripts actually look like they're giving you really good benefits, 20% faster, 30% faster, 40% faster. But the thing about public cloud is that when you configure something, you're not incrementally faster. You're playing a whole new game. It's like the difference between a steam train engine and a diesel powered train. They're still running on the same tracks. They're still doing the same things, but the difference between them is just such a world apart. So much more efficient. You can carry so much more load. You can get so much more done for the same amount of money that automation is like fiddling while Rome burns instead of actually putting the fire out. That's my fear, the way I see it. But it's a necessary step.
People, what if I can make you automation to get a beer for you at 5 o'clock every day? You'd sing a different tune, wouldn't you, Greg?
It'd have to be a vodka and tonic.
I get your point. I guess maybe I've been drinking the Kool-Aid a little. I don't know. I know that you're naturally cynical, so I try to uplift your saltiness with my sugar.
Yeah.
And at the same time, and as someone that's writing a lot of my...
You're so sweet.
And I'm writing a lot of this automation, so I can see the change, but maybe I've just got my blinders on. Maybe I've got my 2016 blinders on.
The thing that I would like to, I think, the thing that I see in the industry is that automation is a necessary transition between horse-drawn carts and petrol cars. Right. And you have to go through a stage of, there was a time back in the 1910s when cars used to run on diesel type fuel before we finally got to the right sort of petrol powered high compression engines from the 1930s onward. And automation is that necessary step where people sort of go through and they get all excited about their automation, but it's not where we need to be. The endpoint needs to be much more like vRealize, if you're into the VMware ecosystem, or these types of cloud systems where they take your intent and degrade that into multiple steps quite automatically and invisibly, and all these things just happen and you don't know about them. And that is orchestration. And that is ultimately like, when I configure an ES instance and when I configure a microservices container quite automatically and unbeknownst to everybody else, the backup happens, VLANs are created, IP addresses, DHCP servers are updated, firewall rules are automatically spawned and created, they're added to the security scanning, their change control is notified and logged, and so on. All those things have to happen. And that's not automation, that's orchestration.
All right, shifting gears just slightly, we need to talk about hyperconverged. And Keith, we were just off the record a little bit. Keith, you had a point you wanted to bring up about hyperconverged.
Yeah, so if you look at the overall market, Nutanix has done a great job of leading the way. Great technology. I don't want to take anything away from what that team has done. Amazing stuff to point. But at what point, as a enterprise customer, when Dell, EMC, HPE catches up to Nutanix from a ease of usability and maturity perspective, as an enterprise customer, a box is a box, whether I get it from Dell, EMC, HPE. If Nutanix and the likes don't move up the stack, what's the future of hyperconverged?
Yeah, are we looking at the next thing that everyone will do? Or is there some intrinsic special value that a company like Nutanix or SimpliVity or the rest can bring to the hyperconverged picture? And and adding to that discussion, one more thing I've noticed, I think it's very interesting that most of the major system vendors now have more than one different, completely different hyperconverged solution on the books.
Yeah, HPE's Synergy solution looks pretty interesting when it gets, mature. And that's going to be something, I'll keep my eye out on. But Nutanix's new tagline is that now they're now a cloud company, is their new marketing term, which I got into a little back and forth with the guys on Twitter about that. I'm like, you guys, I'm not going to unleash my developers to my Nutanix clusters. Like, hey, here's the self-service portal, head at it. There's a lot of missing pieces in specifically Nutanix's stack. Is there a vendor who's better suited to become that cloud HCI solution?
There are certainly a bunch of people trying. Rich and I have spent the last few weeks doing briefing calls with you know, probably half a dozen companies who are saying essentially, we're hyper-converged, except cloud, not data center.
Yeah, there's like startups like Cloudistic, ZeroStack, others that are attacking this market, yeah.
You know, and Platform 9, and then there's some new guys. I mean, there's a whole bunch of great companies out there that are trying to be the Nutanix for the cloud.
And I think there's a whole movement here, which is, remember what I said before about complexity, like this orchestration, it's got to be, and this is how I see hyperconvergence. Hyperconvergence is a reaction to the complexity of what we have today. So we have the silos and each silo operates at a different pace. Communication between the silos is very hard. So instead of buying networks from Cisco, servers from HPE, storage from Dell, you know, so on and so forth. What if I could just buy everything from all from one place? Well, that makes, you know, good sense. The challenge is that they do make a significant difference is that I'm no longer building a storage array that's not compatible with my HP servers, and I'm no longer taking the risk for making sure that all these things self-integrate. I'm not taking the self-integration risk. But what they're not doing, this is the automation orchestration. While they automate my X CPUs and storage and some of the basic connectivity of the networking and some virtual switching, they don't actually move the needle in terms of orchestration. They don't click a button, get a VM. And, you know, rightly not. I don't think that that's going to happen. So it'll be a while before we get to a situation. And until that's what they solve, I don't believe that we're going to be able to see them make a difference. They're always going to be bit players in a game, if you know what I'm saying.
So I want to maybe turn Keith's question around a little bit and say, do you think that Dell and EMC can actually do eventually what Nutanix is doing? And not because they don't necessarily have the technical chops, but because of, you know, potentially business issues. Like, you know, if the I see a hyperconverged unit and I'm an HPE, I'm thinking, and I'm in the storage unit, I'm like, that's, you know, an array that I'm not selling, or that those are servers I'm not selling, and that can create issues inside the company.
I think it's complicated in that we have to make our private infrastructure. So if you want to build on-prem infrastructure, it has to operate like the cloud, not because the cloud is public cloud is better or whatever, but because it actually solves a genuine business need. And hyperconvergence is a step in that direction, in that by getting my storage and my compute and my networking to be automatically integrated with the software that runs it. So instead of having to worry about operating systems and switches and server blocks and blah, 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 somewhere above that, there's a layer of abstraction that just says, add another rack, add another 10 servers, I've got more compute, more whatever. But still above that, there's another layer of software which hasn't come out yet, which is, how do I automatically instead, you know, how do my developers say deploy this container, firewall rules, you know, and this is stuff that Amazon does in its cloud. When you create an instance or a service, access to the internet is automatically plumbed in, firewall rules are created, monitoring is instantiated. When you log into your account, in identity and authentication management is part of their IAM process. Those are the things that we don't have today. And I don't think until they're solved that, and you know, VMware's had a good go at this with its VxRail and VxRack. And I think VMware might have made some mistakes in deploying it, but equally the customers, you know, the partners that were supposed to sell it, you know, Dell and HPE and Cisco, really didn't want to sell VMware's private cloud solution, if you like, because that would prevent them from adding value to their products. Mm-hmm. And so now we've got a market deadlock where the vendors are actually driving customers to the public cloud instead of creating private cloud solutions that customers can actually use. And, you know, they would rather have, at the moment, we're sort of headed on a path where big incumbent vendors would rather have all of no market than to have half of some market.
That seems a little self-defeating.
Yeah, I can understand it, though.
Does that make sense? Am I off the rocker there?
Yeah, I think you're right in the aspect of it. And one of the things that I look at, my big wish, I wish HPE would have done it because they had all of the moving parts, especially with their Helion components. I want hyperconverged cloud inside, yes, of my infrastructure. I want to have all those services. You know, I look at Azure Stack. I haven't really played around with it enough to know if Azure Stack is going to be that for me, but I want Azure Stack combined with Nutanix. I want their love child. I want to be able to when I run out of capacity, I want to add a new brick and all of the service layers, that everything, all the stuff that needs to happen behind the doors, all that integration work is already figured out for me. All I have to do is add another brick to my data center stack, and I get a bill from whomever for the additional capacity or licensing. You know, we're enterprise companies. We don't care about cost. So just as long as it's simple, that's what I'm looking for.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, and that's the secret too, is enterprise doesn't look at cost in the same way that normal people do. And that's a key realization, I think.
So we had mentioned companies like Dell Technologies and HPE, and 2016 was a big year for both of those. With Dell, it finally, you know, they finally swallowed the elephant with EMC and are now existing as Dell Technologies. What does this mean going forward with these elephants with Dell Technologies and HPE?
Well, I guess it remains to be seen. You know, we've seen word that I'm hearing is that they're still in a massive disruption internally, which, you know, you really can't blame them for given what's happened.
You're talking about Dell specifically or both?
Well, yeah, Dell specifically. And I'm sorry, yeah, I'm you know, between the Dell management, the EMC management, and of course, there's also a lot of shaking up happening at VMware as well related to this whole thing. But, you know, it remains to be seen what's going to happen with that. But it's such an important company, and it's going to be such an important company just because it's so huge. And they have so many products, and everybody is, I mean, basically everybody is their customer. You know, in a way, they're a too big company. And, and speaking of too big companies, you also have HPE, which is another too big company. And it even decided it was too big and split into two, but it's still too big and getting bigger.
So you think the getting smaller part, the divesting, is allowing them to be more nimble in a focused market? So instead of being, so my complaint earlier about vendors saying, we've got one of everything, customer, you buy it, we'll sell it to you. That's the answer that HP is pursuing. Whereas Dell EMC is going the other way and saying, we're going to get bigger and have more solutions and more choices because that's what customers want.
Yeah, I don't think HPE is doing that. I think that they're trying to focus on, you know, the enterprise. And of course, that's, you know, it reminds me of I used to know an independent car mechanic, and on his store it said, we specialize in all makes, foreign and domestic. Well, that's HPE. They're specializing in all data centers, regardless of, you know, cloud, whatever, you know, we got that. We got that. So they're not focusing. No. They're just focusing on the enterprise. They're just, you know, which is still pretty big.
But they did divest a whole bunch of legacy software businesses, too, in an effort, I think, to slow down. True. And.
I mean, they got rid of all that HP enterprise software, that HP software business unit that was such a pain in the butt.
Yeah, I'm being too critical. They are focusing somewhat.
Yeah, and I mean, that was an $8 billion, multi-billion dollar, I'm not sure if it was $8, but it was certainly a multi-billion dollar divestment.
Yeah, I thought that was overall a good move. I hadn't traditionally been very impressed with HPE software.
Now, they were a pain to do business with, yeah. So maybe they've gone to the right home where a shakeup might get them more focused on an outcome instead of torturing customers and infrastructure experts like us.
So I'm really good at that.
At some point, HPE is going to grow. They're going to buy someone, and there's going to be consolidation in the industry. Where's the weak points going into the next year in the industry where we there's just too many players and there's going to be consolidation in specific markets? Storage, maybe? Is there any more storage that needs to be brought up?
That's a good question. And yeah, I mean, I can definitely see that there are still some independent storage companies out there. I mean, you've got NetApp really trying to be the independent storage company. You've also got, of course, HDS. And then you've got these new guys, you know, Nimble and Pure are absolutely vying to be, you know, the next EMC as well. Does the industry need the next EMC? And what does that mean for those four companies?
On the networking side, we've still got folks like Brocade and Extreme.
Juniper.
And Juniper and Avaya. Mm-hmm.
They're all sort of sub.
Do we still have Avaya?
Do we still have Brocade?
It remains to be seen.
Don't
still...
be mean.
Don't be mean. I mean, Avaya's business is still call centers and PABXs. And so, yeah. You know, Avaya's revenue and the networking stuff that came out the side, it's hard to know whether that's going to be profitable on its own. And if Broadcom buying Brocade and for its SAN business and promising to spin out its networking, the Ruckus and the Foundry, you know, for lack of a better word, the IP networking business. I mean, how many buyers of those products are there? It seems unlikely.
That's the problem with poor Brocade. Yeah, who's going to buy that?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, it's going to depend on the American economy. I think if fundamentally the thing that's driving a lot of private buyouts of IT infrastructure companies is the fact that the cost of raising debt is so cheap that it's very easy to get a return over a 3 to 5 year period. But with, you know, if Trump stays in office and does actually get an economic bounce when a president comes into power, he gets a 6 month, what is it, mm-hmm. they call it the free ride or the golden road for about 6 months before the reality kicks in. And that could cause things to slow down a little bit while the uncertainty or, you know, whatever. But I think in networking, I think the disaggregation, this white box, is eating away the market. And in the same with it, and that's going to have an impact as the cloud, public cloud is clearly here to stay. And there are, and the general agreement is there are things that are well suited to being in the public cloud. I think there has to, at the end of the day, be a disaggregation where buying proprietary storage hardware makes no sense when it's just so much more convenient to just put software on top of x86 servers that's got a few hard drives in it. Or, you know, in networking, it's white box switches running commercial operating systems or, you know, and so on and so forth. What we did with servers is where we're at. You know, we buy our x86 servers and then we choose what operating system we put on them.
And so far, well, you know, again, I keep coming back to storage. That's what I do. So far, that's not a thing in storage, despite the efforts of so many companies who are trying to create generic storage software. So far, we really aren't in a software as a separate purchase mode for storage.
Mm. And again, is this because customers aren't willing to change? They still expect to buy a shrink-wrapped box, one throat to choke, and, you know, hold on to it for a decade. And so the vendor can not only get the upfront sale of the hardware of non-proprietary, but, you know, low-cost hardware, plus they get a 10-year trailing revenue stream in maintenance contracts for this thing. Is there a disruption that is going to occur when customers suddenly realize that this is just open-source software running on x86 boxes?
Yeah. Well, so far it's not, and I think that's the key difference. The minute it becomes just open source software running on x86 boxes is when that disruption happens.
Mm. Yeah, and I guess it points to a major skill gap I think I see in the enterprise. We know how to operate vendor kit from Cisco, CCIEs to VMware, VCDXs. We can send internal folks to training to get up to speed on these technologies and become experts in any single vendor's technology. But open source kind of doesn't have those same rails. And I'm struggling with a model in which that scales from a training perspective. And we take traditional sysadmins and we put them in these open source environments where we're doing more than what we did with Linux, and we're taking white boxes and molding them into what we need in the enterprise. That's the part of it that's getting a little fuzzy for me.
I think the other realization that I'm coming to is that vendor training actually isn't technology, is not actually giving you, it's giving you skills, but it's not giving you knowledge. Increasingly, it's like, how do you drive the car? Mm-hmm. So if you go and become a Cisco, sort of VMware, HP, you know, whatever it is, you're perfectly competent at driving the car, but you're not a mechanic.
And that's the problem. So for the model that we have today, or that we had yesterday, I don't think it even works anymore today. But for the business requirements that are being driven, we need that ability to know how to build a car or even repair a car versus know how to drive the car. And without that base training and that army of engineers that know how to build and engineer cars, how are we going to go to this white box open source model at scale?
I think we're back to our chicken egg problem that we kind of started out with.
it's not a straight. There's no answers here. I think, you know, we're in transit. This is what makes me, you know, when we came up with the title for the show, the question is, what's really changed in 2016? And all of the things that we're talking about.
What's the answer?
I actually don't feel much has changed at all. Although there's an acceptance that there is some possibilities for change. There are new technologies, new ways of doing business. There's a realization amongst CEOs, like executives, that your IT department isn't actually very competent and that something has to change. Something needs to be fixed in that area. There are new technologies coming down the pipe that are emerging. Now, having said that, Nutanix just got away for a $2 billion float. So, you know, yay for them. But it's still very early days. I mean, and there's still so much competitive space. It's not certain that changing your department to take up any of these things is necessarily going to give you a result, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the easiest answer is that there's going to be plenty to blog about and podcast about for 2017.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
See how I tied that all up?
Oh, that nice was job. Very
smart. Very, very well done.
There, look at that. Well, that sounds like a segue right there.
True professional.
I think that is a segue. Thank you, everybody, for participating on this look over the last year. Folks, do you want to tell us where you can find us on the internet? Stephen Foskett, where can folks find you?
Well, I'm at sfoskett on Twitter. You can find me at blog.foskets.net, where I write about whatever I feel like, or at gestaltit.com, where I write about enterprise tech.
All right, Keith?
You can find me at CTO Advisor on Twitter, and you can find my musings, thectoadvisor.com, and I have a occasional podcast there as well.
All right, Chris?
Yeah, I'm at Chris Hall on the Twitters, and wallnetwork.com blog, and DataKnots podcast. Woohoo, DataKnots.
All right, go for the DataKnots. Ethan?
At EC Banks on Twitter. My personal blog is ethancbanks.com, where, like Steve, and I write about whatever I want, and all my enterprise techie stuff is at packetpushers.net.
And Greg?
You can find me on Twitter as at Ethereal Mind. I'm also lurking around on other fine social media, if they're LinkedIn, Facebook, and so forth, if that takes your fancy. And of course, I blog mostly at packetpushers.net, and every now and then poop out a little trouser nugget on my old blog at etherealmind.com.
Now that's marketing right there. All right, I'm Drew Conry Murray. I'm on Twitter at Drew_CM, and I blog at packetpusher.net. Thank you everyone for joining us, and thank you everyone for listening. This is our last podcast for the 2016 year, and we hope to see you all on the other side 2017. Take care.